The first person to make our presentation this morning is a member of the Senate of the of Maryland, and this is Senator Jamie Raschen, who is in the Maryland General Assembly and has been since 2007. He is a professor of constitutional law at American University Washington College of Law. He directs the program on law and government and the Marshall Brennan Constitutional Literacy Project, a nationwide program he founded in 1999. Senator Raschen has written many articles and law review pieces and essays, a number of books, including the 2003 Washington Post bestseller, Overriding Democracy, The Supreme Court Versus the American People, and We the Students. In addition, Senator Raschen is an active pro bono lawyer representing a variety of clients in constitutional rights litigation. Senator Raschen.
Good morning. Forgive me for being a little bit late. I'm another victim of MapQuest here. But I was able to find my way eventually. And I also, but I understand that the real keynote speaker fell through at the last minute. And so I was invited. And I don't mind being second string as long as you don't mind my having nothing original to say here. One thing I would like to just establish before I start is how many people here are from Maryland? Could I see a show of hands? So maybe like half or maybe a third. Okay. So nobody else has any idea who I am, and of course, probably the people from Maryland have no idea who I am. But that's all right. I serve on the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. I have a strong interest in and passion for civil rights and civil liberties. In my real life, I'm a law professor. I teach constitutional law, and I do a lot about civil rights and civil liberties. And so I'm something of an accidental politician, in fact. When my colleague Bob Dinnerstein is here, who's a famous disabilities lawyer and scholar who understands these things, but when I first announced for the state Senate, the Washington Post had I was running against a 32-year incumbent who was the president pro tem of the Senate, and the Washington Post said that my chances of winning were considered impossible. And then 9 months later, when I got 67% of the vote in the primary, they said that my victory was inevitable. So I went from impossible to inevitable in 9 months. But I've gotten to spend a lot of my time working on issues dealing with the civil rights of people who face discrimination. I'll tell you a little story about the very first civil rights style bill I got to work on. It related to restoring the right to vote to ex-felons, people who had been convicted, served their time in prison for an offense, and then got out and had every other right restored to them, but not the right to vote. And this was something that was always of concern to me. When I was elected, Maryland was one of only 10 states, like Mississippi and Alabama, who disenfranchised people for life. So I went to see, upon my election, the late distinguished and beloved state senator from Prince George's County named Gwendolyn Britt, who had been introducing this legislation for a decade to try to restore the right to vote. And I told her I was very interested in working on it, and she said, great. And she said she'd be in touch. And then she came up to me on the floor one day, and she said, I got the felon reenfranchisement bill out of committee, and I wonder if you'd like to be the floor leader. And I said, you know, I'm really honored and delighted. I'd love to do that. And she said, well, don't be that honored. You're the only white senator willing to do it. And I said, all right, well, I'll take it however I can get it. And the minority leader got up and said that the Democrats want to give the right to vote back to murderers and rapists and armed robbers and terrorists and arsonists, and then sat down. And then Gwen turned around and said, okay, Jamie, you can get up. It's your turn now. But I had one argument who were waiting for them. And I said, the vast majority of people who are going to get out of prison, unlike the people you're talking about who are never going to get out, are in for nonviolent offenses. And I said, let's take one of my constituents, for example, Jack Abramoff. Okay. Jack has just gone off to prison in Western Maryland for 6 years for offenses against the integrity of our government and politics. If anybody should be disenfranchised for life, it's somebody who's engaged in political corruption. At that point, all the Democrats got up and wanted to speak for the Jack Abramoff Voting Rights Act. And then we passed it by one vote, and we re-enfranchised 86,000 people that day. And somebody came up to me and said, what kind of district do you represent that you can make speeches like that in this? And I said, you got to come out to Silver Spring and Tacoma Park and check it out. So I don't know if I've got any of my constituents here today. So, oh, I do. I've got it. I've got one. That's great. I've done some bills related to the rights of the disabled. The first one I did actually was right when I got into office in 2007, which was to give victims of job discrimination or housing discrimination or public accommodations discrimination the right to sue in court, because the law had always been that you had to go to the Maryland Commission for Human Rights. It was an administrative claim, essentially, and you turned the claim over to them. And if they liked it, they pursued it. If they didn't, then they wouldn't. And so the legislation I introduced was simply to give people the right to go directly to court if the administrative complaint wasn't brought. And so this vindicated the right of a jury trial and the right to compensatory damages for the disabled, as well as other potential victims of discrimination. I was very proud to work closely with the disability rights community in Maryland, which has a very strong and savvy political team working in Annapolis. I remember during that first legislation I did, one of the witnesses against us, because there's always a lobby that doesn't want to expand anybody's civil right to sue, because the theory is that this is anti-business. It hurts business to give people the right to sue if they're victims of discrimination. And one of the witnesses said, I don't see how this is a problem, because nobody can sue. If you're disabled and you're discriminated against, you can't sue. If you're African American and you're discriminated against, you can't sue. If you're a woman and you're discriminated against, you can't sue. So it's not discriminatory because it affects everybody the same. And I remember I told this story that my father had told me when I was a kid about a professor of philosophy named Sidney Morgan Besser, who had been subpoenaed for jury duty in New York. And he was in the jury voir dire pool, and the judge was interviewing people, and came to me and he said, well, Mr. Morgan Besser, this is a case about police brutality, and before we put you on the jury, we want to make sure you haven't had any experience with the police that was unpleasant or unfair. He said, well, actually, I had one experience with the police that was unpleasant, but it wasn't unfair. And the judge said, really, well, what happened? He said, well, I was going to this peace rally in Central Park, and these two police officers came up to me and started beating me on the head with billy clubs. And the judge said, well, that's terrible, but why do you say it was unpleasant, but it wasn't unfair? And he said, well, when they were beating me up with their billy clubs, it hurt a lot, so it was unpleasant, but they were doing it to everybody, so it wasn't unfair. But we got that bill passed. I did another bill that I got to work on in 2009, which broadened the definition of disability to include people who've had a record of being disabled and people who are presumed or thought of or conceived to be disabled, even if they're not. And again, I depended very heavily on the disability activists and lobbyists in Annapolis to help me get that through. But that legislation did end up passing overwhelmingly. This past session and the session before, my main focus was on marriage equality. And we passed marriage equality in Maryland. Thank you, yes. And it was a big victory for us. And it's not over yet necessarily because it may be petitioned to ballot. And so this may go to referendum. A lot of the trick with this legislation was getting people to see that there's a difference between civil marriage, that is getting a license to marry, and religious marriage, what a church decides to do. And for me, that's the key to understanding the whole issue. No church or mosque or synagogue or congregation will ever be forced to perform any marriage rites or wedding ceremony for anybody that they don't want to marry. And so churches have every right to discriminate against the same-sex couples or, for that matter, interfaith couples or interracial couples. They don't have to do it. The churches control who gets married in the church hall. But when we're talking about city hall or county hall, there everybody's got to enter on equal terms because that's what first-class citizenship demands. And so I think that it was a process. It took us a few years, but we got people to see that giving people equal rights in the public space doesn't mean that a church has to alter whatever its own doctrine is. And so I was very excited to see people's minds changing. This is an issue like the rights of the disabled where public opinion, I think, is in rapid transformation. People's ideas are changing about this all of the time. One senator said to me that I was in a little discussion with a few about it, and one senator said to me, well, he didn't think he had much of a problem with gay marriage, but it was gay sex that he had a problem with. And another senator said, well, if you don't like gay sex, you should definitely support gay marriage because everybody knows there's no sex after marriage. Actually, we had a few Republicans come over and support us on this, and one said, well, he supported gay marriage because he thought that gay people had exactly the same right to be miserable as everybody else. So there was an opportunity for some interesting perspectives that people offered. When I think about the situation of the movement for the rights of the disabled, I think it's got affinity to what we just went through on the whole marriage equality thing. The argument for giving gay and lesbian Marylanders the right to marry was not that they were identical in every respect to straight people. The argument was that they were first-class citizens, equal citizens, and as such could not be denied access to a legal and social institution that confers a bundle of hundreds of rights and duties and benefits and responsibilities and privileges. So we were able to win the debate by shifting it up to a discussion of civil equality and freedom from the prior discussion, which involved a lot of stereotype and a lot of discussion of differences about gay people being perceived as a kind of foreign social, cultural, or biological species, and when I first got into office, gays were often portrayed as being, frivolous or frilly or threatening or elitist or snobby or too effeminate or too butch or too macho, what have you. And whatever these perceptions and stereotypes were, and whatever their accuracy or inaccuracy, they became irrelevant when we focused on the equal rights of people in public places. We don't deny citizens the right to vote because they're too effeminate or they're too masculine or what have you. And so all of those images that people have of other people's identity are really irrelevant in the final analysis when we're talking about what people's rights should be under law. Now, having said that, I also have to say that the single biggest indicator to me that someone was going to support our legislation after their political party was whether they really knew any gay and lesbian people and had the chance to set aside stereotypes that they had about them and that they were able to think of them as friends or associates or family members with real human characteristics, just like straight people, some of them warm and nice, some of them reserved and cold, some of them liberal people, some of them conservative, some of them moral people, some less so, and so on, that as gay people became humanized to our colleagues, we had a much better chance of capturing their belief in their equal rights under law. And in that sense, I've got to say it helped a lot that we finally have one out gay member of the Maryland Senate, Rich Madalino. And over on the House side, I think there are 8 or 9 openly gay or lesbian members. And that undoubtedly, you know, improved our prospects. Now, you know, when we dismantle barriers to public accommodations, jobs, housing for gay people, and when we do the same for marriage discrimination, we make it all the more likely that there will be an even greater integration of the gay and straight communities and a further reduction in barriers and superstition. Now, I don't think that the existence of a gay and lesbian community will fade away when we've taken down all those legal barriers. But those communities will have less salience, perhaps, when the minority groups do not feel besieged and under the gun and always having to fight for their equal rights. And surely there will be positive aspects of the gay identity that people will hang on to even when we get to a situation of equal rights. And some will have to do with the history of the struggle for equal rights, and some will have to do with different aspects of a dynamic gay culture going forward. But I don't think that the identity will be so overwhelmingly important for most people, and I certainly hope it won't be, since to my mind, the negative part of having a ferociously held identity politics, whether it's about sexual orientation or race or what have you, is the idea that you are what you were, or you exist only in the capacity of being a victim of other people's prejudice or other people's discrimination. And I think that that ends up being stifling for people if you have to define yourself solely as a victim of other people's misunderstandings. The liberal ethos, which I want to defend, suggests that we're all in the process of becoming and developing our individual energies and talents, and we don't have to be trapped by the limiting definitions and stereotypes that are imposed by a majority, or that some people want to embrace and hang on to exclusively as a group tag. You know, we should never forget what we once were. In the Jewish faith, which I belong to, we restate every year at Passover that we were once slaves in the land of Egypt, and we also take time to recall the calamity of the Holocaust. But even these significant hard facts cannot exhaust our sense of who we are as Jewish Americans today or what the modern experience has been, much less tell us how to resolve serious issues in our country or around the world. So while knowledge of the past is necessary to effective understanding and negotiation of the present, it's never sufficient. And if we treat it like it is, then that knowledge becomes an obstacle to effective understanding and appreciation of what our prospects are. So when we look at the movement for the rights of the disabled, obviously we're still aiming to complete the same kind of journey to first-class citizenship in all aspects of life that gay and lesbian people are seeking today. We want people with disabilities to be treated like first-class citizens, not only with respect to political and civil rights like voting and marriage and school attendance and public accommodations and transportation and education, but also with respect to the workplace, the professions, the trades, the internet, which is something we've been working on, and so on. And so this requires us to shift the debate again, away from people's prejudices and stereotypes and towards the ideal of equal citizenship for all. And I think in that process, of course, we need to break down social barriers between the able-bodied or the temporarily able-bodied and people with disabilities, to break down the kinds of superstitions and stereotypes that allow people to continue to support discriminatory policies and obstacles to other people's advancement. And, you know, of course, in the case of disability, we're dealing not just with dismantling stereotypes that exist in other people's heads, but we're also dealing with taking down material obstacles to equal rights that exist in respect to the construction and design of public spaces and architecture and public spending on things like wheelchair ramps and elevators and Braille translation and so on. The obstacles faced by the disabled are not only social and psychological and political, but also physical, sensory, and architectural, and they require reasonable accommodations, of course, which is the, you know, the key concept that we've been able to use to move these questions through the law. So we're in a struggle that continues to go on, I'm delighted that there are that this is an activist community and it's an assertive community and it's one that really will stand on rights and demand change. And I should say, finally, as a personal note, I went through a medical struggle over the last 2 years, which fortunately has abated for now, but I had a diagnosis of cancer and went through radiation, chemotherapy, surgery several times, and the experience affected, obviously it affects you in a lot of ways, emotionally and psychologically, but also affected my ability to operate in different places based on different things that they put inside my body, and it affected me in terms of metal detectors and airports and stuff like that. And you know, as I was going through it, I thought that I wasn't really interested in like toleration, people tolerating, you know, what I was dealing with, and I wasn't even necessarily interested in a sense of inclusion or charity on their part. I was just interested in the ability to participate and to do the things that life required me to do, That opened my eyes to what I think a lot of disabled people experience, which is you just want the world to be able to connect with your abilities and your disabilities so you're able to negotiate the different channels of life. But I learned one other thing that I thought about, which is the difference between a misfortune and an injustice. If you get a negative health diagnosis, it can happen to anybody. It, at some point, will happen to almost everybody. Except for what we do to the environment, it's basically a question of chance. And that's a misfortune because it exists in nature and people have been getting sick and people have been getting hurt forever. But if the society is set up in such a way that people who are sick or people who have disabilities are not permitted to develop their creativity and their energy and to express themselves and to participate on equal terms, that's not a misfortune. That's an injustice because we can do something about it. That has to do with the way that society is organized. And as I went through my experience, what I realized was that life is filled with enough misfortunes for everybody, enough difficulties that just exist. The last thing we need to do is compound it with the injustice of unfair arrangements and exclusion and obstacles being put in the path of people trying to lead their lives with dignity and with happiness. So that's all I have to contribute. I wish I knew more about the field and the subject, but I am delighted and honored to be with you this morning, and thank you for having me.
You want to take a chair and see if there's questions.
Sure.
Take one of those.
So, Senator Raskin, if you'll take a chair there and one of those mics, we'll see if there are questions for you, and let me start. Rights protected by the Constitution are those listed in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and those that are regarded by a court as fundamental. We have a right of privacy, which is nowhere listed in the Constitution. It seems to me that a right to information is becoming very fundamental. If you can get it, you can participate, and if you can't get it, you can't. And I wonder if you have any opinion about whether or not there's a way to get a protection for a right to get at information. I understand that the right to read is not regarded as a fundamental right, but we are creating the information age, and this is new, and there's a lot of it, and it's out there, and it's being developed fast. Do you think there'd be any way to protect it using the constitutional principles that you know?
Right. Okay. It's an essential point. The Supreme Court has found in a couple of decisions that people have a right to information in a negative sense. That is, information can't be taken away from them. There are cases where particular groups have gotten to public libraries and essentially banned books, removed books, and the Supreme Court has said in those cases there's a right to information. But in the sense in which you're referring to it, is there an affirmative right to information, for example, access to the internet, which I know is much on people's minds? The court hasn't found that, but I do think that there is an important constitutional value about people having access to information. It's also been embodied in a lot of statutes like the Freedom of Information Act and the state corollaries to that, because lots of states have essentially FOIAs. We are in Maryland fighting for an extension of our public accommodations legislation to require large internet websites doing business. We set the figure at $1 million or more a year to have technology that makes it accessible to people. But I mean, I wish we had a constitutional principle that that forced states to do that or forced Congress to do it. I'm afraid it's going to be much more like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, where states are doing it on their own and it slowly builds up over time, and then maybe we can get Congress to exercise its power under the Commerce Clause to do it. Hopefully we'll get there.
Are there other questions for Senator Raskin? Okay. Sharon Manecki. Megan is managing the mic, so.
Thank you. Good morning. Senator Raskin, you started out your remarks wondering if anyone knew you, and I'm proud to say that we know you very well. And I want to, first of all, compliment you on your leadership in the Maryland General Assembly. I've had the opportunity to watch many folks in committee. Many of them do various things when witnesses are there. You, on the other hand, are very attentive. You always have questions. And we certainly appreciate that. Now, I was wondering if you might comment on Maryland is one of a few states that does not have, that does not allow minorities to go to state court if they are discriminated by a place of public accommodation. And I'm wondering if you could maybe make some comments on that, where you think that might be going and that type of thing.
Yes. Thank you, Sharon. And I should say she was the model ideal lobbyist that I was referring to before. She's a powerhouse in Annapolis. You couldn't be better represented there. If you please tell my wife that you think that I pay attention, because she thinks I have attention deficit disorder. She's probably right. The original bill I talked about was one relating to job discrimination, being able to get people into court and to bypass the Human Rights Commission. And you're right that what we don't have is a right of individual action in court with respect to public accommodations. It's something we've been fighting for over the last couple of years. And I think that it's something that will pass when we can get the full engagement of all the civil rights groups across the spectrum. You know, I think that some of the civil rights groups feel like discrimination in public places is no longer such a big deal, so they don't really understand it in the way that the disabled community understands that it's a very big deal. But we had, as Sharon, you probably remember, we had an African-American woman who talked about being turned away from a motel on the Eastern Shore, I think last year or 2 years ago, clearly because of her race. And so these sorts of things still do happen, but obviously they affect the disabled more now than it does affect, other minority groups. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. I mean, to me, if we're going to have civil rights coalitions, it's all about solidarity, and we have to stick together and, you know, feel other people's pain. So I think we're going to make that happen over the next year or two. And I certainly know if you've got anything to do with it, we probably will. Sure.
Well, Senator, we appreciate your coming very much. We appreciate your comments. The Federalist Papers had a bunch of commentary about how it was that factions were going to create opportunities to express interests in the legislature that were of concern to various groups in society. And the faction name now probably gets to be known by special interests. This is a very important special interest to us, and we appreciate your coming and sharing with us and participating in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you so much.
Sorry you can't stay.
Yes, but thank you.